Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Simmery, and this is a very special episode. You get to listen to some cool music while we're having this conversation, too. I am currently in Toronto, which is very exciting for a lot of reasons, and hopefully you will check out the episode about the Feminist Porn Conference, or possibly two episodes. So hopefully you check that out as well. And while I'm here, I am freaking out. I'm super excited because I get to talk to Karen BK Chan, of whom I am a huge fan. How are you doing?
I'm awesome, Timmery. It's very early in the morning for me. So you're catching me when I'm very vulnerable.
Oh, this is going to be raw. Okay. So the way a lot of people might know of you is from your video Jam. I've posted it on my page repeatedly. Could you give like a basic idea of what that work is?
Yeah, for sure. This is a video based on an amazing essay I read in Yes Means Yes by Thomas Macaulay Miller. And it is about what his essay is called is Towards a Performance Model of Sex, which talks about moving sex towards this idea that we have about music or dance, where experience is actually counted towards your personhood and towards your how good you are, and that we are expected to make mistakes, and we're expected to not really know what we're doing and what the outcome will be when we improvise in music and in dance. And so I just took that, I got his blessings to make an animation out of it, because I found myself just reading this essay to everyone I loved. And they were getting sick of me reading, so I just wanted to make it into a video. And so the video is all about how if we use an improvisation model, then so many things we already know about how improv works can apply. Everything from you can't really force someone to improv. You can't say, like, you must improv with me, I bought you dinner. Improv is like an ongoing process where you're always checking in to say you're still into this, right? Or you're still into doing what we're doing, or should we change, right? So for those reasons, it's a really fitting model.
So the video compares sexuality to like musical dance performance, which is a big difference from a lot of the other analogies that have been used about sexuality, like of course the baseball model. Are you familiar with Al Vernacchio's model as well? So he's got the pizza idea. And I talk with my students compare and contrasting the two different ones and how they have different utility. How do you think that the Jam model is different, better, more useful than any of the other analogies? Because, you know, there's an endless number of analogies for sex.
Mm-hmm. And I think the Jam model is a good model for a certain aspect of sex, which is right now actually something we really need. So it's a great model for thinking about what sex looks like, for thinking about how sex should proceed, and thinking about how consent works. I think the other models are really good for thinking about how to decide what you desire and how to decide what you desire together with someone else or by yourself. So I think they're all good models, but the Jam model really addresses some of these issues that are right now extremely contentious, like consent.
Consent seems to be like the really big piece that has often been missing from sexuality education. There's a story that's going semi-viral as we record this about Mississippi sex education program that uses this peppermint patty model to describe basically how women are like ruined after sex. One of those many things that are told to kids about how, you know, you put tape on somebody's arm and then you remove it, and obviously that tape can never stick again, and so you were therefore less valuable. What the fuck is, what have people been doing? Why have they been using these ideas?
I think those are really rooted in misogyny and in an idea of what sex does to you and how alien and unnatural sex is actually within the human condition. So if we push sex to be something sinful or dirty or negative, then when we engage in it, we have to like cross over some kind of goodness boundary. And so that's a place of shame and guilt and all that stuff. But if we really see sex and sexuality as being really innate, and desire all of them as being, however you want to say it, honorable, sacred, natural, then we're asking different questions entirely. But I do think that all those things about women being ruined specifically have to do with misogyny and have to do with this idea that sex is about possession. And so, especially because women or many of us have parts that are inside, and somehow like being colonized by an outsider is a pervasive idea that I don't think nobody ever said, this is directly why I think of women's bodies this way. But I think those ideas of colonization also apply.
I was having a discussion with my students the other day about this idea, and to them, this is just like the only way to conceptualize it, that, you know, a vagina is invaded, that sort of thing, that, you know, having X number of things go inside of you, the physics of it. And I was talking about how another conception that I've read about, perhaps in like older Indian writings about sexuality, is the idea of consuming, and that the vagina is actually overwhelming, and being like, what could be a more vulnerable position for a human male than a sexual act in that way? And they were like, what? Because it just never been framed in that way.
Yeah, and one of the things that I love doing is puberty education for, you know, kids who are 8 to 12. And in that is an opportunity to shape someone's idea of the world. And so all the verbs, all the action words I use become really important to me and to the whole session. So instead of saying something penetrates or something is inserted, that when male parts get all the action words and female parts only get to receive, I think that paints a certain idea, a certain picture. And so a lot of the words I choose are like, if the vagina is around the penis at the time, then the semen would enter or whatever. And, you know, the egg pulls the sperm in. So I think just by sometimes reconceptualizing what parts and who does what, we can actually change a lot about ourselves and what choices we make.
And there's so much like intrinsic disgust for bodies in a lot of this as well, that not only can the female body be ruined very easily, you know, with the purity myth, but how gross must be male bodies if being touched by one ruins you? Like, we're intrinsically taught that our physical forms are bad. And I mean, to me, this is just Calvinism manifest now. But like, it's just implied.
Yes. And I don't remember who said this. Somebody wise and famous, I think, said that as long as we think of urine and feces as being completely abject from the body, then all the parts which are connected or sometimes the same, i.e. the genitals, will also be forever ruined in a way, and seen as abject. So somehow, if we can embrace all of the body's ways of being and conditions, that we will be closer to that world that you're talking about.
So that's interesting, because that makes me think of like the taboo of anal sex, right? And how obviously the massive amount of nerve endings is why someone might want to do sexual things around it. But yeah, that's like the worst, most bad sexual place that you can do stuff. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's funny because sometimes I do this exercise where I ask people to go around and just name something that gives them pleasure. And in a group, mostly we talk about what comes up is things that we like to eat and things that we like on our skin. So most people will name baths, chocolate, different foods they love. And if somebody then names something a little bit more intimate, it could be a sound they love or someone who they're intimate with, their words or holding their bodies, when it goes towards those kinds of things, there's like a weird shift in energy in the room. Sometimes it's a welcoming one. It's like, okay, let's get into it. And other times it's a really clear distinction. Like, that is not okay. We don't want to talk about that. That makes me feel extremely exposed.
So the workshop that I took from you at the National Sex Ed Conference, you started out with a thing that I had personally never experienced, which was we stood around in a circle and you had us all start with a beat, and then we had to introduce ourselves while we were maintaining it. And you talked about how this is like stepping outside of the comfort zone but not going into the panic zone. Do you use stuff like that to get people started a lot of the time?
I am learning how to. I actually got that exercise from this thing that I learned a lot from, which called creative facilitation from Partnership for Youth, an organization that does amazing work around the world. And I just really loved bringing back in the body. I think this is something I'm trying to build on too. The absence of the body in work that is all about the body is so weird, but such a standard. I'm a big excited learner in that realm.
And then one of the other interesting things is that you had us introduce ourselves by name, by gender, and then I'm going to get the prompt wrong, but it had to do with something that would be very arousing and exciting to you, but not necessarily the on-the-face thing, but what it represented, like the underlying thing. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, the prompt was, think of a fantasy or a desire you have. And often when prompted by that, most people think of, you know, I want to have a threesome, or I want to be tied up, or I want to be with somebody who's famous, and then they name the person. And what I asked your group was to name what was it underneath that that actually turns you on. So when you imagine, let's say, a threesome, it isn't necessarily that you can count the number of people in the room that really turns you on. It's like once you get to three, something gets excited. It's not that way. What's exciting for you might be that it's new, or it might be that it's only three this time, and normally you have eight people, and it's like so intimate suddenly. So if people can get to the point of naming what exactly is it about it that turns them on, it gets to a different level. And this is my interest in moving, for example, the conversation away from sexual activity, which is a little bit of what the pizza model does. It's like, what would I like to do, versus what am I feeling and why, and what does it mean to me, and what might it mean for me and someone else if I'm with someone else.
So when I was trained as a sex educator, we talked about, you know, after any experience, you know, what are the feels like, and having to use entirely feelings-based words and to shut off the executive function of your brain, and you can't critique the production value of the thing you just watched, and you can't have, you know, whatever sort of frontal lobe, you know, rationalizations you're going to use. Instead, you have to get down into the real stuff, and it's incredibly hard, and academically proficient people seem to have an even harder time with being honest, that they have used that higher order defense mechanism stuff for so long that they've never had to actually address the emotions that are underlying that end up shaping their beliefs, that they use these cognitive rationalizations to explain, but in reality they aren't at all the point. Yeah, I don't know. How do you address that kind of thing?
I think asking and inviting is definitely the way to go. This is one of the foundations of the some of the anti-oppression work I like to do. So often anti-oppression in the circles that I travel in right now is done with a lot of sort of cognitive interventions, a lot of explanation and definitions, and this idea that you must understand and therefore you will choose right. And what I think we all can witness is that most of the time the blocks and the barriers are not intellectual, they're emotional. They are, I feel defensive because I feel unheard, or I feel like, why do I try so hard and still I'm not good enough for your sense of what a standard is, or I just don't feel understood, I'm always, you know, anyway, a slew of feelings that get in the way, actually, of people aligning their politics. So I feel like asking and inviting and then empathizing, actually, is a huge tool in just being able to articulate and feel our feelings. And so much work can be done that is not done right now or not done easily can be done once our feelings are out on the table and fair game.
So I don't know if I actually even properly introduced what your title is. Like, so you're a sexuality educator based in Toronto. With which populations do you work the most? Which populations are the most fun for you to work with, etc.?
Well, I have a couple of different roles that I take. I have a job at the city government doing sexual health promotion as well. And so within that job, I'm work with people who live in Toronto and play in Toronto and work in Toronto, all ages. Right now, I work mostly actually with sex educators who work with those populations. And then in my own work, I work with all kinds of folks, often in workshop settings, and I'm going to move into more consulting with individuals and couples eventually. But I also do a lot of contracts with schools who want extra or additional complementary education on top of whatever's part of the curriculum. So with I think those are some of my favorites with kids who are anywhere from like age 4 to age 99. And you know, it's funny because I'm calling them all kids, but I do actually think if we're able to just assume that we're all quite naive, like myself included, we just have so much more possibility. And when I talk to kids, they're so open. And, you know, one of the things that comes up that people talk about is like, oh, you don't want to teach kids to things that are too complicated about, like, gender. You know, just keep it at 2 for them. And then when they're, like, older, you can teach them about other stuff. Kids are actually not the people who get confused. Yeah. When you tell them, there are different ways and there are sometimes things that don't fit and sometimes things that fit. They totally just nod and go, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, I think for adults it's more about unlearning, which is more difficult because, first of all, you have to reject, like, that everything I've been told up to this point may not be right, which is a step that a lot of people are not willing to do. Exactly. Even if you, like, consider yourself to be, you know, open-minded or whatever, but, like, there's a lot of investment in every, in all the institutions and the people that taught you those things, and so to reject the dominant paradigm that you've known for your whole life is not only to learn something new, which can be challenging, but to actually reject all those sources of information as being infallible. Yeah. It can be really trying. But kids, you're like, not necessarily tabula rasa, but a little bit. So we, you know, we've been in town for this porn conference, and you work with kids, and so, you know, access to pornography is like ubiquitous, especially if you've grown up with a mobile device, you know, your entire life. So what do you do around porn education with kids?
I've been thinking a lot about this recently, and I've been asked a lot too. Often the question comes down to, is it good or bad that this generation has so much internet access to internet pornography? And I always think it's neither. That just like every generation, we've been exposed to new technologies that actually stun the generation just before. And I think we are changing as human beings, that maybe in the West, that sexuality is becoming something that younger and younger people have expression for. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It might freak some of us out, but it doesn't mean it's a bad thing. So regarding porn, I think just like most things, it's literacy, it's some kind of emotional allowance, so that, for example, with like 10-year-olds, what I talk about besides, you know, how do you close your browser or what do you do when you see stuff that you don't, that isn't meant for you, I also talk about how scary and exciting at the same time it is. So you might feel completely drawn to it because you know it's taboo. You know you've never seen this before. And you know it's kind of exciting for your brain and maybe your body too. But at the same time, it's terrifying sometimes. So I think like that part is really important, as opposed to like jumping right to like what is the right thing to do, whether this information is too much for you or if it's way too sexual. And I think if we can trust people to make choices for themselves, people including young people, they're gonna be fine. But we gotta equip them with ways to deal with all the stuff that comes up.
So what I'm hearing is actually not that different from the sort of need for media literacy in general. The like, how can you read a celebrity gossip magazine without getting really fucked up by it? So that seems, in the States certainly, that media literacy training is definitely lacking. And then you had the added complexity of the fact that it's technically illegal. They shouldn't be viewing it anyway. And that someone else might get in trouble for the fact that they're accessing it. But what do you have to say about, like, so kids will get exposed, they will be curious, it will happen, some other kid's going to show them, whatever. What does that do to a developing brain? What is the effect of viewing whatever type?
I think a couple things. The general saturation of pretty sex negative but extremely sexual imagery and ideas in the world right now, in the at least in the overdeveloped world, is changing kids' brains. So they're using sexuality as a language. They interact with each other with through sexual or using sexual capital. I think that is really hard to stomach for a lot of people, especially for a lot of parents. And at the same time, I do think it's something we might actually have to accept. It is how we changed as well in the eyes of the generation before us. Another way that it's really changing that I think we can do something about is that it's limiting our imagination. I think porn becomes this shorthand for how to have sex, which is so not the case. But so many kids are quote-unquote learning how to have sex, and this is how it's put, but I don't think this is what's actually happening. I don't think they are going to porn and go, I want to learn how to have sex, so I'm going to watch some porn. I think it's mistaken as a representation of what happens when people have sex. And so what we need to do is give not only the permission but the prompts and the fodder for more imagination. So just like, you know, magazines for I don't know, the ones you were talking about, celebrity gossip, all those things really limit our imagination of how we can be just as people, and they enforce a kind of normativity that is actually not achievable, gender-wise, body-wise, you know, wealth-wise, and so on. The crisis is imagining. Is in imagining, yeah. So if we can somehow create more and more ideas and ways to just have newer ideas of how to be and how to have sex and how to carry your body and how to talk to someone that you're interested in and how to be in a relationship with or without institutions of marriage or ideas of monogamy, like if we can just make space to have a bigger imagination, I think we can address some of the harm that porn does when it's widely accessible on the internet.
So the thing that just always gets me like super excited whenever you're talking is how everything is just so expansive, and it's about being it puts this really stark contrast between the template driven idea of fitting in and doing things at a particular time and in a particular way versus the idea of fuck that, like that's not necessarily good or real or sustainable, like figure it out as you go along. Like, is this how you approach everything?
Personally, professionally, well, you know, like I get so serious talking about this stuff, but the truth is, like, all the things that I'm talking about are happy, exciting, joyful things, right? Like imagining how else you could be in relationship with yourself or with someone else. I do feel so thankful when I can approach life that way. And I think this is one of the things, like if you're a terrible instrument player and you've always struggled with, let's say, how to play the piano, you actually might end up being a great piano teacher because you know what it's like to struggle against something. And so sometimes I think of that as being a strength of mine, that I come from extremely restrained, constrained, linear, you know, shameful kind of education, kind of upbringing. And so it's really familiar to me, the struggle against a lot of things. And so, yeah, I try my best.
That's huge. I just had this like epiphany, this looking back on the conference this weekend. There's somebody that was at it, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
That's one of my favorite pornographers.
Yeah.
Jennifer Lyon Bell.
Talked to her last night. So one of the things that kept coming up in a lot of the sessions, and certainly the, you know, the women of color one that they all shared in common, talking about, you know, what brought them into the world of porn. No one was like, oh, my parents were super sexually permissive, you know, like they were hippies and like people were all naked all the time. And I was definitely encouraged into this. Like everybody's been very supportive. There was none of that. None of that. Everyone was like, I grew up, nobody even mentioned sexuality. It was just like, didn't exist. And if there was a conversation, it was very much like, don't get pregnant because you will then die. Like, but that can't be, is that, why is that? Like, and how did we all end up here? What is the thing that, like, turned that light switch on and not only are we like, okay, we're cool with sex, but like, I'm gonna go do this for a living. What is that about?
Well, I think it's funny because, I think it makes so much sense. I think for me, a lot of the work I do, I talk about it as work I have to do for my own healing, like for my own sense of, I'm okay in the world, and the world is okay with me. And that doesn't come easily, and so I feel really lucky that I can make it my work to bring that message. You know how a lot of people say therapists are actually therapists because they have a lot of issues that they want to deal with themselves or they're yet to deal with? I feel that way totally. Like, a lot of the messages that I, you know, say passionately to a child are the things that I'm saying to myself still. So that's how I approach it, is around healing and just making my world the way I want it to be. How did you get into it?
Well, you know, I just keep thinking of like how Courtney Trouble yesterday was talking about, and other people have said this as well, like to make the stuff that you would have wanted to come across as a kid, that if you would have been a teenager and this had been your first introduction to porn or to sexuality, that it could have, you know, saved your life. They could have really saved you a lot of time and trouble and heartbreak, if nothing else. And I grew up in a, you know, my parents are pretty cool. They're fairly educated, but, you know, it was a generally sex negative environment, just the geographically, and, you know, K through 12 Catholic school and all that sort of stuff. And it was really helpful that I had parents who are both sort of like a little bit rebellious. You know, they're educators, and so they, you know, just like have this sort of like stand away from the institution and talk back to it a little bit. And that was really helpful for me to be like in theology class. And Mr. Cordes, I know that you taught me about Maslow's hierarchy needs in like seventh grade, and I'm appreciative of that. But you got to stop with this like super sexist stuff when we were talking about the Old Testament, because that is a bunch of bullshit. That like the wife's job to submit sexually to her husband, like that's her obligation. Like, what if she doesn't feel like it? Like, is she not a person? Does she not have choices? And I'm like, in seventh grade, and like, such a dork, such a dork, because I'm just like, you know, we're sitting there in theology class, and like, of course, my hand goes up every 4 minutes so that I can argue with the teacher, and everyone else is like, you're in seventh
Stop
grade, you're not
it.
Supposed to care. Yeah, you don't, you're not supposed to care about any
what
of this stuff.
Recess.
basically, yeah. And then I got into a lot of fights with theology teachers in high school about whether or not homosexuality was bad. And, like, you know, I had friends that, like, you know, they agreed with me. And I know this because we were friends and we talked about it. But they were never going to say it in public because then everyone was going to think that we were gay with each other. And, like, it was like, oh, no. Didn't you think it's bad, too? Like, that's the thing. And I just, I think what was useful for me as a kid is that once I realized that I was never going to fit in, like, I there was it was never going to work. Like, even if I tried, it was never going to work. That was really liberating. Because then I don't have to anymore. And so I think that for me, doing sexuality education is telling other people the same thing. Like, mm-hmm. you're no one's ever going to fit in.
Yeah.
Not, like, that template, that cookie cutter is so small. But no one's going to fit in. So just fucking do you.
Yeah.
And I think that's sometimes not to belittle experiences of marginalization and oppression. But, like, it's when you have to struggle, like, against, you know, ideas of, say, your gender or your sexuality, that the basis of that struggle is already you don't fit, so what are you going to do? And that's very liberating if you can get to that point.
We're both sexuality educators, but we work with very different populations. I don't work with kids for the reason that I'm kind of scared of them.
For their honesty?
I feel... I've never really grown out of that, like, fear that kids, like, are judging. Because I think that, like, that insecurity that people feel as kids, like, you know, I still feel that a lot. And so with adults, it's easier to manage. But you evidently don't feel that way about kids, or...
No, I totally do. And actually, I think of that as part of that healing that I'm doing. Like, going into a high school is one of the scariest things, because it does. It's kind of like going to a family reunion. You become 14 again. And so going to a high school where I was, when I was a high schooler, I was severely harassed. And I couldn't even go into the cafeteria because... I was just such a gender weirdo, and things would fly across the cafeteria to hit me in the face because people were throwing shit at me. And so it was just like a hard place to be, and high school was one of the worst, you know, some of the worst years of my life. And so actually to return was actually good, because I, like, it was one of those places that were too scary to go to. And so by going there in a different capacity... actually slowly made it okay, and I feel really good in schools now, and it gave me an opportunity to become the person I wish I was back then. So I think it's actually a huge opportunity in that way. But yeah, kids are terrifying and scary.
Plus, then you're a role model going in there for, like, all the other little kids who are experiencing, like, a similar not necessarily the same degree, but, like, you know, they can look at you and be like, that is a totally different model for how I can be a person. And I remember, I mean, I feel like this is silly to say out loud, but I remember the first time I saw Gia. And I was like, what? What?
Yeah, totally.
Like, role model. Up to that point, it had been like Catra in She-Ra, yeah, you know, right. As far as options. I'm like, I'm never going to be She-Ra. But it could be Catra. That's realistic. So who, like, you obviously, maybe not obviously, maybe you didn't have role models growing up for what you wanted to be like as an adult. Who really inspired you or informed you when you were growing up to be the adult that you grew into?
This is really kind of embarrassing. Firstly, thank you for putting Gia in my head.
My pleasure.
This is embarrassing to say, but one of the people that actually had a lot of influence on me, most of which I projected onto her, was Katie Lang.
Oh, okay.
'Cause when I was 16, 15, she was the only person I knew who was androgynous. And she was famous, and still is. And so I thought I could identify with her simply in even an aesthetic. And I had mistakenly thought that she and I were aligned in so many ways, i.e. at the time I thought I was a boy trapped in my girl body, and I thought she thought so too in her body. And then one time she showed up on Arsenio Hall. Do you know what that is?
Mm-hmm.
In a sheer blouse that was very girly, and I was like, oh fuck, you betrayed me. Like,
oh, no.
You're not who you say you are. But then that was also very illuminating. I was like, so what is she about? And I had not, in my imagination, could not nurse her existence. Like, so you are this really butch person who is comfortable in a blouse that is sheer, and I can see your black lacy bra. So she really changed me in that way, that she broke some of my hopes, and therefore some of those molds that held the hope. And what I really loved about her was I had read this magazine article that said she is strangely attractive to both men and women. That was how it was put. And I was like, I want to be strangely attractive. And that became a kind of a goal. But I read a lot of first wave feminism kind of books when I was 15, 16, only because that was what was available in the tiny library that was in my city. And so I was very influenced by a lot of old and often dead white women. And I'm still thankful for it.
So that's an interesting point about the number of like androgynous celebrities who are put up. And like, I think there are certainly more options now than before, but there really are not that many options. And I remember being a kid and seeing K.D. Lang and being like, how did they let her through? You know, they seem to have this incredibly narrow vetting process for who's allowed to be famous.
Yes.
How did she do that? Like, she like snuck up the greats. Like, yeah. What? Like, what? And then how, like, was it just like the talent of her music? Is it that great? Because it wasn't my kind of music,
right.
So I didn't understand it. I don't know. What, like, what is that? How do we get more of these varied images out there?
I think she rose to fame actually as a weirdo. Like,
okay.
She was a country weirdo, and country is certainly not my thing either. And yeah, I don't know how we get, but I do think like the proliferation of technology now has really changed what and how people become famous, and that's a real help to a little bit more diverse kinds of imagery out there and a little bit more diverse options. But yeah, like fame and celebrity is something I often abstain from, so I don't know actually most of the celebrities and famous people that I should, because I work with young people, but I really have to abstain because often it's bad for me, bad for my soul. And I can't follow, it's just too much.
Yeah, that. So I use Celebrity Gossip magazines when I am working with youth to use it as the let's talk about these issues, you know, like so-and-so's pregnant or so-and-so's getting married, whatever like the issue is. And then we're talking about someone that we all know without gossiping about someone that we know.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how certain kids get it much more than others about why is this person and their story on the cover. And it's also a really good way to talk about like media ownership and like, okay, so this magazine is owned by this company that has this movie studio that has this movie coming out kind of idea. And some kids just get that a lot more than others. And it seems like the kids who are of color or the ones who are queer, like they understand that marginalization a lot better. But like how, like so much is like geared towards the aesthetic and the taste supposedly of like white, cisgendered, straight people. But in reality, they like to consume a lot of different stuff
mm-hmm.
when given the options. We see that in 2013, the movies that had more female representation did better. The TV shows that had more diverse casts and writing staffs actually did better.
Mm-hmm.
How do we go forward with this if we're not actually making the media ourselves?
I actually think we are, right? Like, a lot of times the vloggers and the bloggers now, I'm shocked because they're super famous and they turn out to be, like, some kid in the middle of Wisconsin, right? And Yeah, I feel, I wish somebody would have a class where I could go to like once a week and just get updated and told what I'm supposed to know about the dominant pop culture stuff. As well as like some of these more smaller producers of but largely consumed kinds of media. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
I think we should put out a call, and this is like because I would like to do this. So if you do the show, whoever's listening, have me on sometime. Someone needs to do like a weekly show, like a weekly vlog or podcast or something, where they break down pop culture from the lens.
and like make it 101 and say, and this person is, and you might know them from, and like not just do not assume that I watched that movie.
Yeah, but and then also entirely present it from like a conflict theory lens, you know.
Okay. Now you've made the show.
Yeah. So, like, somebody was telling me yesterday, I was completely unfamiliar with James Franco, whom you might know from the Spider-Man movies. Yeah. Okay. So that worked. So evidently, was doing a via Instagram chat with like a 17-year-old, and it's like a whole thing. And so yeah, you would present this as, you know, so white cis male. You know, who has flirted with lines of sexual orientation and then, like, present it entirely through that way. And it points, you know, quote Derrida and Foucault.
Okay. I would watch that show or listen, for sure.
So somebody needs to make that show. And so when you do, let me know and I'll interview you also. So what upcoming stuff do you have that you are excited about?
Sometimes it's actually like too much. And right now, something I'm very excited about is this idea of a series of children's books. And so, if you're listening and you know how to make this happen, please get in touch with me. I'm going to write a bunch of children's books on feelings and what I'm calling 201 feelings. So, with kids that I work with, often they know, like, are you mad? Are you cranky? Are you sad? All those kinds of feelings, but they don't have the words to say things like, I feel regretful. You know, sometimes that nears what they have to say when they say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have lied, or I shouldn't have, you know, forgotten the thing that I said I would remember. But they don't get the word regretful. And I just have been working with this small Montessori school. And with their very young kids, like 4 to 6-year-olds, I've been teaching them words like regretful, and they used it, and they give me great examples of when they feel regretful. And that's just one example. And so I really think if we can name feelings for and help kids name their feelings, that they will just be in a much better place of just peace, right? Coexisting with all these different kinds of things going on in their lives and in their bodies. And so I'm hoping that the series of books will make feelings interesting and something you can talk about beyond, you know, I'm upset.
So why is that important to you? Like, what application do you see this is having for these kids?
I think this partly returns to my own life. I feel like I didn't learn any of this until I was like 26 and couldn't really navigate a lot of my own feelings. Partly is my interest in talking to young people about how they negotiate sexuality with themselves or with each other. So one of the things, for example, that I'm very interested in is working with young boys around this idea of rejection, this idea of disappointment, this idea of shame. Because within a lot of the package of masculinity, one of the things is that admitting defeat and admitting like you've been sunken and defeated by something or an outcome of something is not acceptable. There's no emotional language to like walk away and go, I feel really disappointed, I feel hurt. So particularly my interest around this is in sexual interaction that specifically involves boys, requesting or asking girls for, you know, anything from, like, let's go to the mall to something more sexual, that when they're asking that question, the no is not really an answer that is easy or that they have the language to receive. So we do a lot of education around no means no, and we say, you know, if someone doesn't say yes, then they haven't said yes. But then we don't take care of the person who's been rejected. We just think, like, hey, back off. But in the backing off, that person's also going through a lot of shame, possibly. They're going through a lot of, like, defensiveness, and they might be going back to a group of friends who are going to make fun of them and even more shame there. And even just the disappointment. Like, a lot of times when you approach someone, it isn't just like, hey, I want to, like, see what can happen, and I'm just all bravado. You know, anyone who's done this before knows when you have the hope of a yes, then you have a huge disappointment with a no, or with a maybe, or not you. So I want to work with young people so that they have more tolerance for that rush of feeling that happens when you get a no. How else are we going to be good people at doing consent if one of the options that happens within consent I cannot handle?
I think, there's... I think the narrative that boys are sold is that they should just be, like, indiscriminately firing, right? And so you don't pick the girls based on having a strong feeling about them. You approach a girl because she fits the template of attractive enough. And if she's attractive enough, you try. And so if she rejects you, it doesn't hurt you because they're all the same anyway.
Right.
You just move on to the next fish,
right.
Which obviously is really messed up, and for a lot of reasons for everybody. And it minimizes, you know, not only the value and individuality of women, but also men's feelings and the capacity to experience love.
Yes, and hope, right? And even like this idea of, like, you're just supposed to move on. Like, a lot of times what I notice is that once you get a no, because it's not acceptable, this cannot exist in my vocabulary, what happens is that in my shame, I get angry. So then I start bad-mouthing this person who's just rejected me. I have to, like, distance them. I have to say, well, I never wanted you that much anyway, and besides, you are X, Y, and Z defective in these ways. So your rejection of me is actually good because I reject you more. And this is so classic, and kids do this, adults do this, but there's just so many other ways to be. But the options are not circulating enough.
I'm very excited for that book. So someone make that happen. Someone who's listening or whatever. Right. So how can people find out more about you, more about your work? Where can they look you up? Where can they hit you up if they have questions?
Yeah, look me up. My website is fluidexchange.org. And you can just Google me, Karen BK Chen.
And the jam video is on the YouTubes.
On the YouTube for now. And
for now.
Until the next thing comes along. I think YouTube is here to stay for a little bit. And then also on Twitter, and just look me up. Everything is my full name. I lack the creativity to make more fun names.
Or if you're in Toronto, just be like, hey.
Yeah, Broadview and Dundas. Come around my corner.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right, so I just want to super duper thank you for finding time for this. I've been excited for this, I guess, since December, because that's when I first saw you present. So thank you so much for your time.
Likewise, thank you so much. I'm a big fan.
And thank you, everyone, for listening, and have a great day.
Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to Sex with Timmery. Sex with Timmery, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimmery.com, Sex with Timmery on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timmery_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.
Hello, podcast fans. Adam Carolla here. I'm leading the fight against patent trolls who are threatening this medium. It's not about me. It's It's about the podcast you're listening to right now. If I go down, this show could be next. Visit fundanything.com/patentroll for more information on how you can keep podcasting alive. Thank you and mahalo.